You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, paramedic, bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along. Oh, man.
You can't help sing to that song. It's ridiculously catchy.
I sing it all the time.
I was singing it in the car. I'm like, at first I was very, very, it's okay. But like, it is very catchy.
It is.
Mike, if somebody wanted to get that song outside of listening to it on the podcast, where would they find that?
Oh, I can make a link to it, I think.
Okay.
You gonna put it in a playlist?
Yeah, put it in a playlist.
Yeah, like a running playlist.
Play it on the bus when you're riding around. Listen to this, guys.
Yeah. The only downside of the song is that it makes us distracted and we just talk about the song at
for
the beginning
first 5 minutes. Yes. Every
episode. And we've done it like six times so far.
We have. Guys, welcome back.
Welcome to the Ride Along Podcast, episode 6, From Cradle to Grave.
Lifespan development.
Yes. Tonight we're going to talk all about the things that happen throughout life, and yep. Basically you live and then you die.
But all those things that each age group you have to treat them differently.
Yeah, we did learn that this week.
Different specific things that are very different in treating them in different age groups. So,
yeah, we're at this point we're in episode 6, so this is like 6 classes in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is roughly we've almost been doing this a month.
Almost.
Yep. And, we're learning a bunch. Honestly, I would like to thank everybody, that's listening along, to the podcast with us because, I think I mentioned this on one of the previous episodes. This is so helpful for us, like in terms of solidifying the things that we're learning each week.
Oh, 100%.
Like I feel like I'm way more like up to speed on the things that I should be learning because we talk about them a bunch with you guys.
Listening to you guys go through pathophysiology and listening to how you kind of broke it down, like there was a couple things that kind of clicked differently because of listening to and how you guys had it, how you explained it, and just talking through it between the two of you. So 100%, like it is just a different way of absorbing the information, and some people, this is how it works for them. Yeah. So if we can help someone that's taking class – and to be a better EMT or be a better student, thumbs up.
Sure. Yeah. So with that said, make sure that if you are finding this helpful for you, please let us know. If you're going through EMT school, if it's been something that you've been thinking about for a while, maybe you're using this as a study guide along the way, we'd love to know. You know,
that would be so we've been awesome.
I would be super proud if somebody finds this helpful in some way to kind of help them review topics, because it may be different based off of each curriculum. Like it may not be in the same order, although it seems like it's pretty much a standardized curriculum across the country.
I think no matter what, you're going to get to the same basic subject matter. Right. I mean, it may be organized differently. Priorities may be different. But for the most part, I think you're going to find that it's probably relatively straightforward nationally how it's organized.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good point because I've seen how a lot of different classes are organized, and it really does depend on the individual instructor as to like how they find their flow best goes when they're teaching. And everybody's a little different as far as setting up their program. But to you guys' point, across the board, we've got to learn the same fundamental information. Mm-hmm. So you're going to hit all the high points. But as you said, Max, the priorities may be a little different depending on who's instructing the class.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah. In my experience, I've seen the flow is usually pretty similar.
Cool. I'm enjoying the process.
Yeah.
More than I thought I would. Like, I think it makes sense. The progression makes sense from a, you know, kind of mix of practical skills. We're having a good old time going along with the EMT training and doing this Ride Along EMT school podcast.
Well, I get to hang out with two friends. So like, it's all good.
It's a pretty good excuse. You know, why don't we get into our sponsorship slot for this week?
It's pretty cool.
Which actually isn't a sponsorship. So this spot is normally reserved for sponsors, but now and then we'll use it to highlight a cause we think is important to our listeners. Organizations doing good for people out there performing often thankless service. Today we're spotlighting the Code Green campaign. Since 2014, Code Green has been raising awareness about mental health and suicide prevention for EMS providers, firefighters, dispatchers, and other first responders. They've collected and shared over 1,000 personal stories, giving a voice to the struggles behind the uniform. Their mission is simple but vital. Break the stigma, start the conversation, and connect our community with the resources we need. Learn more or get involved at codegreencampaign.org, because asking for help should never be harder than the job itself.
Yep. Great cause.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure one that you've seen people kind of need from time to time.
And you know, as you were reading that, I was thinking about it, and culturally it is sometimes really difficult for those who are the helpers to ask for help themselves.
It's true.
Oh, they're the worst.
You know, the Code Green campaign is pretty near and dear to my heart. So I'm glad that we were able to kind of talk about it and share it with our listeners.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think it's a good one. And one I'm sure we'll talk about some more as we go through the podcast too.
Maybe we can talk to somebody from there.
That would be great.
Get them on the podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that idea.
I do.
I need to start reaching out to some people. I think we're 6 episodes in. We got to see if we can get some EMS professionals in here just to kind of get some stories. Those will be bonus episodes. I think that'll be a good time.
Agreed.
And all walks of life. If you are interested in coming on the podcast, reach out. Send us an email at ridealongpodcasting@gmail.com.
Yep.
And we'd love to hear your story. So we have this week devoted to lifespan development. What does that mean?
Well, it basically means how the body develops over its lifespan. The differences between ages in weight, size, blood pressures, all the things that they're more prone to, things socially, how they're going to interact with you as an EMT.
Look at that. Max is ready to go this week. He's
hey,
we're pretty much done. He just explained the whole thing.
Right. Like, we can just stop right there, right?
Yeah. We're talking about the lifespan development because, you know, I guess you can't treat a baby like you treat a geriatric patient. They have slightly different bodies
and slightly different needs, quirks.
Mm-hmm.
One has a tendency to break. One's made of rubber.
Yes. Which is very much tied to our medical term of the week.
Yep.
Very closely related to the idea of lifespan development, mm-hmm. and how you treat different patients throughout that development. This episode's medical term is a concept from Dr. Corey Taylor, a board certified emergency audiologist from the Des Moines Center for Advanced Rage Therapy. And this is a quote from his latest published work in the New England Journal of Medicine, Weight and Bleed, the Effectiveness of Slipknots as Field Improvised Hemostatic Control. And I quote, "And the rain will kill us all. We throw ourselves against the wall, but no one else can see the preservation of the martyr in me."
Psychosocial. Psychosocial. Psychosocial.
Psychosocial. This was a lot of lead up.
Practice that.
Oh,
yeah, a little bit.
There was at least 2 rehearsals. I was making the decision, the game time decision today, on whether or not I was actually going to sing it.
But so, if you'd like to hear Mike sing more,
nope.
Medical terms of the week, please email.
No, we're not turning that into a regular musical it's segment.
Right along, EMT School Podcast After Dark.
Yeah. Right, the Right Along Karaoke Podcast.
Where we sing nothing but songs having to do with the EMS life.
Well, I'm just gonna AI generate more songs. this week's medical term is psychosocial, which is the blend of a person's psychological behavior, their mind, their mood, their emotions, and their social factors like their family, their friends, community, their culture. and how all those things blend together into forming who they are.
Yep.
And how they behave, which pairs with the physical side. So every patient, you have to kind of assess not only just the physical side, their vital signs, how their body's doing, you know, weight, temperature, all the things that signify the real world, like yep. their actual body, but all the factors too that come into play about how they behave, what their motivations are, what their fears are, what their peer group is like, because mm-hmm. all of those things can have an impact on how you treat that patient.
Because, I mean, you could have a child who has friends, brothers, sisters, mother, father, right? They have that interaction of that family group. Or you could have an elderly patient who's isolated, doesn't have any of that, and how they're going to react to you interacting with them is going to be completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found two examples, and I'm sure Jonathan probably has a whole litany of mm-hmm. examples of this throughout a career in EMS of, you know, like, for example, like a 16-year-old male, if you go to treat him as a patient after he's been injured, but he's in, like, now he's in front of his peer group. Other 16.
I'm fine. Wrong with me.
I'm okay. I don't need any help. I'm cool. But that kid may have, you know, a concussion. He may be injured. Like, he may be feigning yep. or guarding, you know. Sure. And on the flip side, you could even have somebody who's like an 82-year-old female with shortness of breath. And she might refuse to leave her home because, like, she's just worried about her cat.
Yep.
So none of those things have anything to do with their body,
yeah.
their physical health. But if you ignore this concern, if you ignore this behavior, you're not treating the patient.
No, you're not.
You might be treating their vitals. You might be treating their body, but you're not treating the whole patient.
And I mean, how you treat that patient could easily determine what they allow you to do, whether they refuse care or not. It could determine, it's kind of the start of that snowball of them heading to the hospital. You could have a patient that comes to the hospital in a great state of mind, knowing that they're going to be taken care of, which just makes the hospital's job easier. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that patient care is just as important, I think, as anything we're doing with a stethoscope or a blood pressure cuff. Yes, blood pressure cuff.
This is where the customer service aspect of the job comes into play. We were talking about this at work. Oftentimes, there's not a lot medically that you're going to be able to do for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But just comforting them and reassuring them and just, you know, letting them know that whatever their concern is, you can at least help them have a calmer mind. You can, you know, if they're concerned about the, you know, which hospital they go to, if you have the option, maybe you can tell them, hey, you have another choice, or maybe you can get a family member to assist them as far as making sure their cat's okay, to your further example. Mm-hmm. You know, or in your first example, you talked about your the teenager that's injured, maybe putting on a good face for their friends, or they're embarrassed and they're not really willing to answer your questions, right? That's when it's helpful to, like, empty the gym out if they're in gym class and say, all right, everybody go somewhere else. We're helping out this kid. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
But being thoughtful about those sorts of things. The numerous examples over my career of just that kind of thing, that customer service aspect of the job, because it's not all just, you know, tourniquets and, you know, we're synchronized cardioverting people. And, you know, it's not all that. A lot of it is customer service.
I'm going to have to write down cardioverting. And
you are indeed. Don't tell him. He'll figure it out.
Okay. Well, it's synchronized cardioverting.
Synchronized cardioverting. I'm just going to take a stab at it. It's obviously synchronizing, turning a patient, two patients at a time, into a vertical, like, you know, orientation of their bodies, so that their hearts sync up together. Cardioverting.
And then you start juggling them. You know.
So that means when somebody is in a heart rhythm that you don't want them to be in, such as ventricular tachycardia,
mm-hmm.
Or ventricular fibrillation, or any number of things, we would well, actually, in VFib, you're going to defibrillate them.
Mm-hmm.
But in VTAC, you could synchronize cardio with them. So the synchronization part is the monitor or the AED is aligning with the person's natural heart rhythm that they're in, so it can shock just at the right time to ensure that we have the best chance of success to convert them into a regular or normal heart rhythm from the arrhythmia they were in. So
I synchronized like cardioversion. I like the idea of standing the patient's heart to heart much better. It seems like it'd be more entertaining.
I feel like my explanation is better.
Yeah, I agree.
Probably not accurate.
It's more amusing at the very least.
Well, in my head, I have like one patient hanging from their feet from a ceiling and one patient standing and then their heart's, you know, it's...
Yeah, they could share an AED pad.
Yeah, like the AED goes on either direction. As a matter of fact, if you want to hear more about AEDs and a little bit of cardio stuff, check the next episode. We have we're going to be talking about our CPR certification night.
Yep.
So that'll be episode number 7. But yeah, tonight we're talking about lifespan development.
Yes.
And cardioverting.
Apparently. And cardioverting.
Mm-hmm. So where were we? We were talking about, because we were kind of transitioning from the idea of psychosocial, how you treat patients. You were talking about the customer service aspect of it. That changes with different age groups, right?
Yep.
And the people that accompany them.
Yes.
Yep.
So I think it would be good for us to kind of just quickly run down the different kind of major age groups. That we see in, or that were kind of outlined in the curriculum. But when we were going through class, it really kind of broke down into two factors, which we mentioned before. It was, like some key takeaways about some physical factors,
mm-hmm.
Which could be very similar between age groups. Like there isn't a huge amount of difference between say a young adult and an older adult, except, well, there are some different factors that come into play in terms of health risks. But sometimes there's huge differences between similar age groups, like between an infant and a toddler, like the size of the, like their bodies growing so quickly, like doubling per year.
I think one of the main things with when you go in the age groups is just understanding like what is a normal stat for that age. Like that's a huge thing. 'Cause as you're trying to determine what's going on, if you don't have that knowledge at hand, okay, this is normal for this age range, then you're immediately going to be behind the eight ball trying to figure out what is going on with the patient.
Yeah. The first time you see an infant's heart rate and respiratory rate, if you were to compare it to an adult's, you'd be like, oh my goodness,
they're gonna die.
You didn't know what you're looking at because
infants
breathe and pump blood so much faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they got so much less.
Yep.
I guess that's a good starting point though, because obviously we start as infants, right? Like, so there's a huge difference there body wise that you guys just mentioned. And that is like some of the vital signs are pretty starkly different. So like what's the heart rate for an infant? Like 120,
160. Well, yeah. 160 to 120.
160, 120. Like there's a range. Obviously, each age group has a range for qualifying as normal. But the infant is much higher than what we would consider to be normal for adults, which is somewhere around like 80, right?
Yep.
Give or take 20 or so. And I may be talking out of my ass, by the way, because I don't know all these numbers by heart. So
it was kind of like when going over the information, it was very like there should be a common sense portion to that as far as like the ranges in blood pressure, the ranges in respiratory rate, the ranges in beats per minute. But I think it's one of those memorization things that you just have to get down of like, okay, this is what we're looking at for this toddler. It should be somewhere between 120 and 160. And getting all those numbers down, I think it's one of those things you just have to have on hand.
Yeah. And the reality is like, you know, we don't deal with a whole lot of kids. In my career, I haven't dealt with a tremendous amount of children all the time. And that's just to say that somebody else doesn't. But so it is one of those things where you've got to like kind of stay up to snuff on those numbers, on those intricacies that are involved infants and children, pediatrics. So because it's kind of a use it or lose it sort of thing.
Yep.
So with the I think one of the key takeaways from infants that like is so different than anything else is like the idea of one of the things they face, I guess, often is dehydration. So keeping up like signs or knowing the signs of dehydration in infants, because, you know, breastfeeding can be an issue.
And, yep.
You know, just keeping an eye, because that tends to be something that they see a lot. Knowing that, like, hey, you should count diapers, like parents. I remember being a parent going like, hey, I need to make sure that I'm aware of like how many diapers my kid's going through. So being able to ask that from the behavioral side to caregivers and like having that conversation, which isn't even necessarily the patient itself, but the factors around the patient, the people with the patient, or things like the fontanelle, which like you don't have
sunken in.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like a sunken fontanelle can be a sign of dehydration, but like you wouldn't see that on another age group.
Yep.
And that's that's not a good sign.
No,
that's a later sign.
Later stage of it. Like I know my daughter at one point had a pretty nasty state of like diarrhea, and like we had to constantly keep her up on fluids. Like it was a constant battle keeping her up on fluids. So like you were saying with the diaper count, like what's the stool look like? What is she producing? Is it just nothing but runny? Like, is there any solid there? And getting all that information is part of figuring out what is going on with this kid.
So like there's things to look for in infants, and then obviously infants grow into toddlers. So infants are less than 1 year. Toddlers are 12 to 36 months. I like how at a certain point in life you get to classify yourself by years instead of just months.
Why can't we do it now?
I'm like, I'm 1,000 months old. I don't know. What's 12 times 40? 480 months old. Toddlers, they're growing. Big thing here, choking.
Yeah.
Which relates to what we talked about before, the psychosocial behaviors. They like that's how kids that walk around explore the world. They put stuff into their mouths.
Yes, right? 100%. Yeah.
So airways are a big thing for the toddler age, probably more so than the infant age.
Are they eating what they shouldn't be eating? Did they eat a prescription pill? What pill do they eat? You know, there's some pills where, okay, we have to immediately handle this. Other pills, okay, it's not that big of a deal. They'll be fine.
Airway for all pediatrics, really. So, I mean, from infant, because any issues they have are typically going to be airway related or respiratory related.
Right.
So and the big thing about, you know, that aspect of choking, that is an important thing to point out, because of how much smaller and less volume of air that they can move when they have obstruction, it's that much bigger of a deal.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, like like it's all going away right now, and they require so much. Like their respiratory rate's higher, their heartbeats are faster because they need to move all that stuff quicker. So it's going to affect them even.
So immediate intervention.
Yeah. And which we learned in CPR as well. We'll talk about that there.
In episode 7.
Yep. You know, one of the EMT tips or the EMS tips that they kind of talked about was like, you know, making sure that you're relating to the patient, you're making them feel comfortable, which is hard to do with kids, especially when they're scared, the people around them are scared. So just, you know, relying on caregivers and an environment that makes them feel better, like having their parents hold them
instead of their favorite toy?
Yeah.
You know, do they have a blanket that they really love?
You know, getting at eye level to them, like the things that you do with kids so that you're not looming over them.
Yes.
Pretty much on every ambulance that I've ever been on, in Virginia, it is a requirement that you have a stuffed animal.
Really?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
There's a stuffed animal in every ambulance I've ever been on.
That's
and,
great.
And it's for interacting with pediatrics, and they get to keep the stuffed animal at the end of the trip. But you don't know how many stuffed animals I've given out, and that has been the ticket to getting that kid to chill out and let me check them out.
Yep.
Yeah, because they're going to focus on that thing and not on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And kids like stuff. Right. You gave them something, so maybe they trust you a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, all good tips and tactics for kind of dealing with kids. Because then they grow into, from the toddler age, into what they call preschool, which is 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. Still growing, probably getting more motor skills, doing more adventurous things. Toddlers tend to fall down, but they don't do crazy stuff. Yep. And then once they start getting 3 to 5, then they start getting adventurous. So then they start playing with peers and they have interaction with peers. This is where they start having like communication skills with other kids. But their curiosity is a big one for this age group too, that they kind of told us about. So like a good way to connect with them is to, like basically show them what you're doing, show them the stuff.
Right.
Yeah. You know, they get super interested in like, oh, cool, a stethoscope.
And I think let them listen to your heartbeat first.
Exactly.
Yep.
And I think a clear distinction here too, is this is where you can actually do communication with the patient. Because before this point, your ability to communicate with them is pretty much limited.
Mm, it can be. Yeah. Especially like toddlers only start talking sometimes around 2, 3.
So 3 to 5, you can kind of ask them and get some feedback from them. Like what hurts, like what's bothering you.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to get down on their level.
Yeah.
So like instead of towering over them, you get, you know, take a knee and talk to them at eye level. Another thing that I've noticed, some kids are weird about hats. We're all wearing hats tonight.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Some kids are really weird about it. And just taking your hat off and talking to them sometimes makes a difference.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Or when you approach them, taking the hat off before you come up to them.
Yep.
So I imagine sunglasses have a factor too.
There's something about, you know, kind of the psychosocial aspect, something about like us as human beings when we hide our eyes, right? It's like we want to know if this person is a danger to us. So, and kids are kind of more attuned to that stuff.
Oh, there's so many cues with the eyes and the way you're using your brows and how you're moving your eyes. I mean, it's the same thing with animals is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But even with adults, like, you should take your sunglasses off.
Yes, exactly.
It's just, I realize I do that just because I don't want to be rude.
Yeah.
But from a practical standpoint, I imagine that there will be times when we're, you know, performing EMS services in the daylight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I hear that you guys are night owls. So, you know,
some of us.
Like, you know, just the simple act of like, you know, making yourself open to conversation and, you know, connecting with eye contact is a huge bonus and probably a really important factor to treating the patient.
I have been in tens of thousands of homes. And the simple action of taking your sunglasses off so they can see your eyes, wiping your feet on their mat outside their door, immediately it's like, okay, this guy cares.
Yeah.
And it's a simple, easy thing that immediately diffuses a lot of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. So we got school age that's till about 12. And then you move into the adolescent.
Oh no.
They're
the worst.
So, oh wait, I'm sorry. We skipped school age because there's something important in school age. So, the preschool is 3 to 5. School age is 6 to 12. Why they call it school age, I don't know. Cause you're in school the whole time.
You're in school till
you're 18, sometimes longer.
Maybe it goes back to when kids didn't necessarily go all the way through school.
They just finish at 12 and they become functioning members of society.
About 12 is the start of puberty.
Yeah.
And then we start treating those people or those patients, start treating them more like adults
in our
interventions. And I think that's probably one of the reasons we make that distinction in EMS because because at that point, you know, once you start going through adolescence, then you can start to treat them as an adult, right? They get the full size AED pads, like we'll talk mm-hmm. about in the next episode. So
school age, I think the important thing to remember is that's when they start developing morals, independence. Mm-hmm. Like they may, like you may run into a school age kid that was off doing something that somebody doesn't know happened.
Right.
Whereas a kid younger than that, they usually have a parent right there that will know what's going on at all times. They start having peer influence, like they're going to be concerned about, like that 16-year-old who didn't want treatment because his friends are nearby. A school-age kid can be concerned because they're embarrassed. They don't want to be treated in front, or they don't want their friends to think that they're weird. You know, like all those things start coming into play around this age and then into puberty.
One of the things that the book usually talks about, and it may have mentioned it for you guys, is these kids start to worry about, like, if they are injured, having some sort of permanent or disfiguring type of injury because they don't understand, you know, how their bodies work, and maybe they've seen some media or something like that where people get injured and they have real fears associated with something has happened to them, and they're afraid that it's going to cause some sort of permanent issue.
Yeah. Right. Like something that they'll be a pariah.
Like what they don't understand is they're going to look so cool.
Yeah. A scar across your eye.
A
hook for a hand would be awesome. Like Hook Hand from Tangled.
Exactly.
You can tell that I'm a dad.
It is one of the best Disney dad. It is really good. Anyway.
Like once they start getting to that school age, you have to start thinking about modesty, which really leads into the adolescent age, puberty. Kids start developing different traits, body traits, sexual traits, like all those things start coming into play. And really it starts becoming like, hey, you need to treat them as adults with sensitivities and like things that, you know, like they don't want things disclosed. So you may want to take them away somewhere, you know, out of earshot of their peers or other people or their parents.
Yeah.
You know, adolescence is where you can start, you know, encountering kids that might be pregnant. And like, it's not your job to reveal to their parents that they might be pregnant, right? Like
substance use is one that I, you know, picked up several kids there at one time in at one early onset of a school year at the high school, and everybody that marijuana is recreationally legal in Virginia at this point, and so it is a lot more available. And so these kids were taking gummies to school and eating gummies, and so about 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, they took them before they get on the bus, and then they start having issues and freaking out and all the things that come associated with that. And it's one of those things of like, hey, look, I don't care, but what did you take? Yeah. Just so we can, I'm not the cops, I'm not your parents, but I need to know because
I literally can't tell anybody.
Like, yeah. I mean, you know, you're going to pass that information along to the next
other healthcare provider,
and then maybe it's the physician. It's the physician's job to pass that to the parents.
Yeah.
But in the moment, my concern is how can I best provide care to this kid? Yeah. And so both of those examples of, you know, teen pregnancy and, you know, substance use, those are some of the things that they deal with. The other is self-harm.
That's you know, the insidious part is the body image and self-harm. And that is across the board at a higher rate than it ever has been. And it's like a disease they catch, because once they start doing it, it just becomes this thing that they continue to do. And it is really an insidious thing where they see themselves as not good enough because of what they're constantly seeing on Instagram, all the socials, pressure from friends.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just kind of sad.
Definitely a lot of factors. And I think this is where like that adolescent stage is where things start getting, I would say, more complicated.
Oh, 100%.
Like, because that's when we start becoming adults, right? So it's one of those ones where you have to, like, I think the thing that stuck in my head is like sensitivity. Like,
yes,
it's where you have to be sensitive to what they're telling you, what they're like, you know, kids can be easy. It's almost like an algorithmic type thing where it's like, hey, if A happens, you can try B, and then, you know, that may help with the situation. But like, you know, once kids get into the puberty stage and they start getting the raging hormones and stuff and like emotions,
you just got a drop down menu of A to double Z.
Yeah. It becomes not equations. No. It's like, you know, the tides.
In my experience, they can, if you're giving them a line of bull, they can
smell it. Yeah.
They can smell it. And I just try and be honest with everybody and real with everybody as much as I can anyway, being sensitive to whatever the context of the situation is. I just try and be honest with them, and, you know, because they may not like your answer, but they will appreciate the fact that you were real with them.
Yeah. Yep. And treating them like a peer instead of a kid.
And once they flush out that you're being dishonest with them, that's it. Like your ability to
They're not going to talk to you.
Yeah, the interaction's over with.
Yep.
I've seen a lot of providers in my career who they're good clinicians in their skills. They can really do a good assessment. They can really do, they can really like do all the skills that are required in EMS. But when it comes to that customer service aspect, like we were talking about, and when it comes to that, how to talk to people, I've seen some people really, really struggle. And so if you're listening and you know that that's something that you struggle with is like interpersonal communication, you should definitely work on that. That should be an area you try and focus on building up.
Yeah.
Because when we start talking about these different psychosocial things with these different groups of people, you're going to encounter so many groups of people that are different than you are, that you've really got to have that ability to adapt and communicate with them. So lots of communication things going on.
Communication, it's huge.
It's huge.
But yeah, so once you obviously there's a lot to kind of unpack with, you know, adulthood, becoming adults. So like, you know, that adolescent age is where they start becoming adults, and then, you know, it's, then you start running into the like subsex. So like, you know, I think this is kind of like a big shift where you go into adulthood, right? There's you're growing up and then you become an adult, and you're kind of like instead of the years only lasting like a couple of years at a time, now we're talking decades.
Yes.
Right. So, where adolescence is 13 to 18, early adulthood, they classify as 19 to 40.
It's a little bit of a range.
So I'm technically an early adult. Just saying.
Okay. Like, he's on the edge of early adult.
Hey, you know what? I'm telling the story here, man.
That's so funny.
I'm still an early adult.
Interesting.
But like, this is where, you know, you're kind of like the peak health, right? Like your frontal cortex is probably becoming mostly fully formed. Although I know a lot of 40-year-olds that I don't think it's still formed yet.
No.
But like the body wise in the 20s peak condition, right? Like you're strong as you'll ever be. But like you start seeing, like you're very healthy, but this is, you know, probably where you start seeing accidents more, like trauma and injuries are probably the leading cause of, things that affect early adults.
19 to 40, the first, 3 to 4 years, college age. I mean, the introduction of leaving home for the first time, being on your own, and then the introduction of, you know, drugs, alcohol, sex, you know, all the things that you've been kind of held back against if you have been. And then you're kind of released into the world. I mean, that's where you're going to see drunk driving. You're going to see all those things start to tick up.
Yeah. So like the early adulthood, the kind of key takeaway was like trauma, like accidents, because typically they're healthiest. That's the healthiest part of their lives.
Yeah.
But don't underestimate trauma, in healthy adults. So that one's kind of status quo.
Yeah.
19 to 40. Not a huge number of things that you got to look out for, but then you start getting into the middle age.
Yep.
The middle age, where some interesting things start happening. Although somewhere in there, like the in between early adulthood and middle adulthood, there is a key thing that changes psychosocially about people, and that's children.
Yep.
That's typically when people are starting to have kids. So their motivations and how you're interacting with them, especially if they're not necessarily the patient, but the caregiver of a patient, they may be in that age range. So understanding how to communicate with them and what motivates them and how they want to be treated is going to be important because you're helping them with their kids. And then they get into the middle adulthood where, things start breaking down.
Well, I think a big part of that is like whatever bad habits you've had through adulthood.
It could be leading to some things.
Kind of seeing a lot of the after effects of the things that you've done through early adulthood that kind of come to fruition in middle adulthood. We're with cancers and diabetes.
I think the biggest one probably being heart stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Cardiac stuff, as far as diet and inactivity, or not getting enough physical exercise, that's a big one. You know, as we go through the podcast, and I'm gonna echo this. The big things that I see that affect people the most are going to be being overweight, and usually diabetes and heart disease go along with that. And then substance abuse, and we can break that down into, you know, your typical drugs, your alcohol, and then your nicotine, or and specifically tobacco.
Mm-hmm. Although I imagine that's probably being – I think it's probably a really good thing that we're seeing less and less emphysema and lung cancers nowadays just because of the decline in smoking. But
– yeah. But with the aging population, everybody who smoked up to this point.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and
now they're at that prime, like middle to late adulthood. Mm-hmm.
Most of the people I see, like I said, they have not led healthy lifestyles through either their eating habits or through their substance use habits. Mm-hmm. And maybe through inactivity, and just, I don't, you know, some of it was that there just wasn't the emphasis like there is now in taking care of yourself that way. People just didn't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are the factors, and you're absolutely right, Max. They start to catch up with you. You're the totality of your bad habits and your lifestyle at some point catch up to you.
Yeah. You can't avoid it.
So, I think the early and mid adulthood, those are kind of like obviously the huge age ranges, like from 20 to 60. Like that's the majority of your life. Mm-hmm. And then the last stage in there, defined as late adulthood. So basically 61 and older.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, you know, I mean, unfortunately no one gets out of this alive, right? Like this is the kind of runway to the end. I know it's horrible to say it that way, but like
life is terminal.
Yeah, it is.
None of us get out of it alive,
which, you know, if we're going to wax poetic for a second, that's what makes it special. Like if we didn't die, it wouldn't be, we'd probably get really bored with it. But this is where we start seeing, decline, in patients, mentally with body stuff. So like, you know, again, kind of compounding what you were talking about before, the idea of those things, the habits over time, like that's obviously going to accelerate for somebody whose, you know, body is going to decline naturally. And then all those things stack on top of it. But the big one, and this is the thing that like their body gets fragile too. So like, you know, frailty, osteoporosis, skin issues are going to be.
I actually have a story about the skin issues because I saw the notes. I remembered I was on a job for a lady. She was cleaning up, and she comes away from you know, cleaning up, and she looks at me and she says, I think this is probably a problem. And she holds up and she has a pencil that is straight through the palm of her skin,
goodness,
straight through her palm, right there, boom, and out the other side.
Wow.
And I sat there with her till her daughter got there. But like, she wasn't like cleaning, like she wasn't doing it rough. It just happened to be that her hand went this way and the pencil was sharp enough to point go straight through the skin as if it was just tissue paper. Yeah. So like that idea of that outer protective layer of your body being that fragile, and as in older patients, you're going to see that, that skin gets almost translucent.
Yeah.
And you got to treat it differently. Like you couldn't strap a patient in the same way as you would if they were younger.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are ways, like you have to take all different things into consideration as they change in life. I think one of the biggest ones is size. Like, sure. You know, bodies change size over time.
Sure.
Like, you know, the different devices and apparatus that we're going to be using to move patients, to strap them down, they're all going to, you have to take the patient into account. Like it can't just, this is my kind of big takeaway from this whole section of like, it's not a one size fits all. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
You might have some pieces of equipment that work across multiple patients, but you really should be treating each one as an individual, which is probably just a really good, like, you know,
it's just a
thing to do in life.
I mean, just in general, like treating each person as a specific person that has different needs, wants, and desires is probably just a good way to go through life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then like one of the bigger takeaways, and I'm sure you've seen this, Jonathan, like, out in the real world, like, cause I just see, like, I see what my parents go through every day in terms of pill burden.
Oh my God.
Like the medication, like the number of medications that people are on as they get older, like is staggering.
Yes.
So like
it's significant.
And that in and of itself becomes something so, important to like what you're doing in the moment, I would assume. Like, hey, you have a patient I don't know this because I don't know much about EMS stuff yet, obviously. But like I could only imagine it being a compounding factor when like somebody shows up, you're like, hey, I'm having heart troubles or I'm having chest pains. And like they bust open a bag full of
just medications.
Yeah.
Right. Like, okay, well, I'm on this. And they may not even know what all of them are. And then you as a medical professional may have to kind of in the moment go, okay, are some of these relevant? Are none of these relevant? Mm-hmm. Is that probably a causing factor or even knowing contraindications in the moment to go, oh, you took that? Well, you can't take Plavix at the same time that you take nitroglycerin. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just saying like you can't take those two medications together and then being able to kind of relay that to other medical professionals, like, hey, we have a contraindication happening right now.
Right.
A drug interaction.
Polypharmacy. Yeah. I see that a lot. And I see the bag of medication a lot. And it's going to be of varying importance as to, you know, how readily, how deeply you look into it, because it's like you said, as people get older, they're on a lot of stuff.
Is
this the cause? Is this the, like, does it need to be adjusted? Are two medications interacting or three medications interacting in an inappropriate way? Because a lot of times doctors are as you age and as you have different things, there's a specialized doctor for everything.
Yep.
Right. And you go to the one doctor and it's not like these guys give each other a call most of the time. they are in the healthcare system as a whole is burdened. So it's kind of a consequence of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's really, really difficult unless the patient brings in their medications or shows the doctor, hey, this is what I'm taking and has a list. I love when people have a pre-made list that I can either take a picture of or I can like copy down. Mm-hmm. And because that is super, super helpful versus the bag full of pills. But most of the time, it's the bag full
of pill bottles. Yeah. Or you get a bag and all the pills have already been organized into those pill holders. And like, now you have literally absolutely no clue what they're taking. Like, it's.
Well, like, there's guides, by the way. Like, you can
find picture guides. There are resources, but emergency medicine, right? What's going to be beneficial to me to sit there and like
figure out what
pill they're taking, or just to treat the symptoms as I get them. Right.
Yep.
And, you know, that's one thing. But I want to touch back on what Max was saying about, like, you know, putting people on the stretcher and talking about that. One of the things that I like to ask my patients, especially if we have time and they're able to relay this to me, is, hey, what is going to be the most comfortable way for you to sit, or what is going to be the most comfortable way for us to move you? Mm-hmm. And somebody that has a pre-existing condition like spinal stenosis, or they have issues with their hips or their back, or, you know, just at work the other night, I took a lady from one hospital to another, and she had two pressure ulcers on her bottom, and we needed to pad those spaces. So right. It took some pressure off of those. Mm-hmm. And these are the ways that we have to accommodate folks as they're in these different age ranges.
Yep.
It's absolutely part of the job.
It's a perfect way to wrap up, is the idea that, like, you have to know what each one of the age ranges, what their needs are, what the risks could be, what could be showing as something that is critical or not critical. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have a good idea of what's being represented in front of you, you're able to treat the patient better, and you're able to get them to care that they need.
Yeah. So I think that's a good way to kind of recap this. It's like, you know, there's a lot of things that we'll need to be aware of, like when we get out there and start treating patients.
Yep.
And things that we have to look out for. And they're not just body wise. They can be psychosocial. Mm-hmm. They can be physical. They can be environmental. They can be all different types of things that may change as a patient ages.
Yep.
So I think it was an interesting week for sure.
For sure. Even though I did it from a textbook.
Yes, because you weren't there.
I was not there.
I had to give Max my notes.
He did. They were wonderful.
You do take good notes.
I take notes on a computer when I can, and that makes my notes way better. I'm one of those people that doesn't actually reread notes. It's my learning process. Like it's my active listening process. I will make notes as I'm going so that I'm actively listening. Otherwise my ADD will just be like, oh, look, a window with what's out there. Oh, I wish I was fly fishing right now. I don't even know how to fly fish, man. I wonder what a trout looks like. This is what happens to me while they're teaching me about like adolescent age things to look at, like, yeah. And to look out for. So I type it and I make sure to listen. But it came in handy because I was able to just shoot him over to Max that night because he was hacking up along.
I did not want to get everyone in the class sick.
Yeah. Which I'm sure everyone is very appreciative of.
Yes.
I don't know if they appreciated the level of sweat that was happening at the last class, but.
No, you're gross sometimes.
I sweat.
You just perspire.
I do.
Yeah. So speaking of in-class stuff,
yes.
I think this kind of brings us into something that we've been using a lot of in class.
We have.
We've had a lot of practice with it for this week's tool of the trade.
Yes, which is the Reeves stretcher. Mm-hmm. So Reeves stretcher is a flexible stretcher that is – the nice thing about it is it's easy to roll up and store in the ambulance. So it doesn't take up a lot of room. And where it really excels – is its ability to move patients up and downstairs. And the fact that as you're moving them up and downstairs, it's flexible. So it wraps around them and cradles them. It really, when we were going up and down the stairs with it, it really made it very easy to stay balanced on your feet. I would imagine trying to do that on a rigid stretcher would be way more cumbersome because you're constantly fighting that weight instead of the weight hanging from the handles themselves.
Now, just to pause for a second, because I there's somebody out there who's probably listening to this going, well, I don't know what a Reeves stretcher is.
So it's
a flexible stretcher or it's a big piece of canvas, right? Like it's a body length piece of canvas with handles around the outside of it.
Yes.
It might be vinyl, but it's basically the
new ones apparently are made of some kind of a polyvinyl that is, moisture resistant.
Non-permeable. Oil,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's what we have at work is the polyvinyl.
Yeah, so it's a polyvinyl, like basically, it's kind of like a tarp.
Yeah.
But it's got handles around the outside of it, strap handles. And then giving it some rigidity is some staves, probably plastic or polymer on the inside. I would assume
or aluminum or something.
That run vertically or lengthwise on this piece of, like this vinyl.
Yeah, down each side of it.
Yeah. Yep. So it gives a little bit of, you know, so that when you're, when you have people holding it, the, like when you put somebody on it, they don't basically fold in half, like feet to head. Right. So it gives it a little bit of strength so that they don't just kind of fold over.
Yes.
That's what we're talking. We've been using it a ton. And I just wanted to explain it a bit because it's hard to, you know, if you say reef stretcher, you're like, okay, I can go look that up. But what is that thing?
And so I have some history on it. It was first introduced in 1902 by Reeves EMS.
Oh, so,
so it's actually a company. The design first being focused on a stretcher that could support patients where rigid stretchers were impractical. And again, where it excels is exactly what we were doing. Like we had four people moving as a group. We had one of us playing patient on the stretcher. It also has three straps that you strap them in with, so they're secured inside of that little taco bundle that you make.
It's an important, important factor.
Yes. And we were able to move rather large humanoids up and down three flights of stairs.
We did multiple flights of stairs, ups and downs. Yeah. We did a scenario-based thing one night doing basically a Reeves stretcher move from a stairwell, up the stairwell, down a hallway, into a stair chair, up a set of stairs, down a set of stairs. So, like, they're putting us through the ringer.
Yeah.
It's good. Like, we're getting a lot of practice, especially with team lifts and making sure that we're not dropping people, which is very important. But the Reeves stretcher has kind of –
It definitely shines in a lot of areas.
Seems like it's the unit or not unitasker. It's the multi-tool, the one that's like, hey, if you don't know what to grab, grab the Reeves stretcher and it's probably the right answer. At least it seems that way.
I didn't work for a department or volunteer anywhere that had one until about halfway through, you know, my career, about 6 years into my career. And it was life changing as far as extracting people from their houses and extracting people downstairs and taking them out of the woods and wherever. Those things are money.
Yeah, I could see why.
They really are.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean the carrying experience. Just the way it allows you to carry the patient changes, because it's just a different mechanics with your arm and with your arms. It's, you're not putting as much of a burden on your back, you're not putting much of a burden on your upper body, just the way it hangs. Like it's absolutely the way to go.
It's pretty cool. Like I mean, it's one of those ones where it's like, it's a dead simple piece of kit.
Yes.
Like it's polyvinyl cloth.
Yes.
With handles on it.
Yes.
Which we've actually probably had a little bit of experience with. So I'm more familiar with things like soft litters. This is like a soft litter 2.0.
Yes.
Like it's a soft litter, but it's got some structure in it so that patients don't fold in half.
You don't get that valley effect.
Which is great for like the professional world where you don't have to worry about rolling that thing up into a backpack.
Yeah.
So
right.
I'm sure we could talk about those at some other point during the podcast too, in terms of like different types of litters and stuff. But I think the Reeves stretcher, definitely one of those pieces we've been using a bunch and kind of like a bread and butter tool.
I think it's going to become a standard for us.
Yeah. I bet you I'm going to have a lot of time holding a Reeves stretcher.
Probably. Stair chair as well.
Stair chair. Yeah. That one seemed like it was like, this seems like I'm going to get sick of these things. I kind of already am. We've had three nights of like extensive, okay, you're in a group of four, get all four people up and all four people down in the stair chair. Like,
oh, God, I keep apologizing to the other students when I'm in the group. I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry.
Oh, I mean, terrible. I'm like obviously the heaviest person in the class. But you know what? That's the cool thing about some of this equipment is that it makes it easier to move people
in
team lifts. Although I almost did dump somebody. A quick story. almost dumped somebody the other night by accident. And it was a learning moment for me using a stair chair during one of those practice sessions. It was the scenario session where we had one person that we were moving in the chair and we had four people. So in my head, I go, well, obviously this seems like an opportunity to put one person on each handle of the stair chair and lift that person up the stairs, because that would be easier and a better use of manpower. to which four differently heighted people lifted the guy in the chair, and it immediately went whoop. And I went, oh, well, that doesn't seem like, I didn't think that would happen. Mm-hmm. And the instructor was there, was like, that's why we don't put four people on. Like, it's a two person lift. I'm like, okay, well, good to know. I didn't know that before then. I was just kind of like, oh, yeah, in the moment, this seems like a good idea. I will never do that again.
Yeah.
So put two people, one on the front, one on the back, and then have a spotter.
Yeah.
And then if you need to take breaks, take breaks.
The good news is you found out in training and yes, not in the real
world. Yeah, exactly.
Because in the real world,
you didn't dump the person. So yeah.
In the real world, I'm sure that old lady would have fallen straight over.
Has an upset stomach. Yeah. Now she has a cranial bleed.
Mm-hmm. Also, I said the real world, our friend Jay is cringing somewhere. Real world
tactical. Every single time I see a post, I comment real world tactical situation.
So that brings us through our student tip, or brings us through our tools of the trade.
Yep.
And we'll kind of get to our last point, or our last regular segment for tonight. And that is our student tip.
Student tip of the night is to prioritize when you come on shift, to participate in your truck check.
When you
do clinical hours, you're going to be on an ambulance with a crew, and you should be paying attention when they are checking the truck to make sure it has all the equipment that it needs and everything is operational on the truck. You should be participating and paying attention, because somebody may ask you to go get something. You may be asked to provide an intervention, and if you don't know where the stuff is, you're not gonna be able to be as much of an asset. So pay attention where your truck check is. If you find a piece of equipment you don't know what it is or know how to use it, make sure you ask somebody. Mm. Everybody should be willing to show you and tell you about whatever it is that you're curious about while you're in those clinical hours. But participate in that truck check as much as possible. And going forward in your career after EMT school, make sure that you continue to do your truck check.
Nah, never do it.
Nah.
Never check.
I'm sure we have what we need.
All right, cool. I think that's awesome. And as a matter of fact, I will have a report on doing a truck check, my first truck check, in a later episode. But we'll talk about that more
in
further stuff. So, yeah. So thank you, sir. And thank you guys for joining us this week. We've talked about the cycle of life, mm-hmm. the from infant to elderly. And, you know, I hope you've kind of learned a little bit with us along the way. Next week, we're talking about CPR.
Yes, we are.
Staying alive. You know,
staying alive.
The Bee Gees. Which apparently there is no thing that has like a radio playing when you give CPR.
I still run it in my head.
Yep.
It's just.
But yeah, so next week is CPR. And thanks for taking the ride with us. We'll see you next time on the Ride Along.
Thanks, guys.
This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing in